This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Jan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs, followed by Done by Law, presented by the Federation of Community Legal Centre. And you have been listening to the Celtic Folk Show. Either through your analogue radio, 8:55 a.m. or via the computer on the webpage of 3CR, streaming for a week, podcasting into the future, or will be revealed at 3cr.org.au. For today on Tuesday Home Time, we hear from writer and activist, former academic, Dr. Tim Anderson. Following his observer mission in Iran, Tim travelled to Cuba, and today we'll share his experiences of shortages but resilience by the Cuban people and his belief that Trump will not destroy Cuba. Then on to Dr. Alison Bronowski, academic, former public servant, author and member of Australians for War Powers Reform. She has a message for a certain Anthony Albanese, which goes something like this: sleep with dogs and you get fleas. Then to Chicago to veteran peace activist Kathy Kelly. And she compares the US war on Iran with that of Iraq 23 years ago, and questioning why the US and Israel are allowed to kill and maim their way through the Middle East. But again, has hope for the younger generation, who will not be as compliant as their parents when it comes to war. Bevan Ramsden from IPAN, Independent Peaceful Australia Network, looking at the cracks developing in the AUKUS agreement, the upcoming IPAN National Conference, and what we all can do to stop the push for war. But we missed him last week, but he's back and raring to go. And of course, I'm speaking of Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was. So plenty to listen to for the next 2 hours on Tuesday Home Time, and you are listening to Melbourne's community radio station, 3CR.
A week, Jan, listener, when I'm scratching my head, and yes, I've washed what's left on top of it, and pretty sure we're all scratching our heads as the mainstream media informs us that appalling Hun Sen's performance at the mainstream press club was a monumental success, leaving us to ponder which bit of white lumpen supremacy, denouncing Islam, denouncing non-whites generally, denouncing people speaking their first language other than English, removing all support for Terranilius non-land non-people, attacking transgender True Blue Aussies, questioning abortion laws and getting rid of parental leave, just to highlight her feminist solidarity, abolish unfair dismissal laws which shackle poor, caring employers with lazy, lazy workers, lazy, lazy, avaricious workers, abolishing SBS and its related non-land, non-people NITV outlet, privatising and commercialising, eviscerating the ABC. Which bit of all that and related policies is success? And which bit of pointing out hypocrisy over opposing wage increases for workers while copping a $100,000 windfall is apparently a criminal offence, an unwarranted attack on that appalling? Thank goodness we've got the mainstream media to explain all that to us, exposing the dangerous leftist anti-True Blue Aussie values bias listeners to this station are forced to suffer. Thankfully, not for long after that appalling gets her way, because there's no doubt she would be forced to rescind this station's licence. A misplaced licence to attack those cherished True Blue Aussie values outlined at the mainstream press club. And what national excitement. Why, she could build a cage in the lodge gardens and we could watch all these brain-dead muscles, UFC, interesting what that could stand for, muscles belt the proverbial out of each other. After all, cockfighting and dogfighting, for instance, are banned, although maybe that appalling could bring them back as well. That would stick it up the goody-goodies who banned such fun, fun, fun. Meanwhile, in the White House cage, a hero, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trample the Paw, killer Trample the Paw, was set for bloody battle with the mysterious Phantom Ayatollah. Kicked off by Killer announcing he had won and the fight would be over in a matter of seconds. And given no one had the courage to upset him by reminding him the fight hadn't actually started, he ran around the cage, arms raised in victory, only to be tripped by the Phantom Ayatollah, crashing face first, which Killer said proved he had won. And just when it looked like the fight might not proceed, a sensation in the Phantom Ayatollah's corner as Killer Trample the Paw's handler, not another Yahoo, leapt on the Phantom's handlers and slaughtered them all, explaining he didn't feel safe, indeed felt terrorized, as long as they weren't slaughtered. Benjamin said anyone who opposed his surprise attack and slaughter was clearly anti-Semitic and supported terrorists. This was the most moral slaughter in the world. While back at the lodge, a huge orange bulldozer roared threateningly toward big supremo Anthony Albanese, our very own filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, waving madly and brandishing a chainsaw, just in case the bulldozer didn't do the trick. The bulldozer towing a Gina plane, piloted a little awkwardly by that appalling herself. The chainsaw, borrowed from Gina's hero, Elon Must Have More, the least he could do after Gina invested $1.4 billion, real figure, in Elon's crusade to head into space and stuff up another planet just like they've stuffed up Mother Earth. I favour investing in industries led by sensible, hard-working, patriotic and exceptional people. Elon excels in every regard, she eulogised. Her Perth office, inspired by Elon quotes on the need to get rid of government and hand the world over to the private sector, especially the Gina and Elon bits of the private sector. Although, beyond the hagiography, there may just be a little bit of self-interest, hard as it is to believe, of Gina. We also see the possibility of mutual beneficial arrangements, she noted, between our critical minerals investments as demand grows for the materials and infrastructure needed to support advanced technology. A technology making Elon the world's first trillionaire and Gina filthier richer and filthier richer. But just one small problem. The whole fragile enterprise is based on technology, the Financial Times, how cruel to spoil the party, Financial Times reported, doesn't actually work. Surely a minor problem, but one problem the trillionaire sorted very quickly, a deal with his investment bankers in which he pays a fee of, this is true, listener, a fee of nothing, zilch. That's why he's a trillionaire. Gina must admire him even more for that. And we must admire Gina for her understanding, accepting that someone has to pay for all that corporate generosity, corporate largesse. Someone. Well, 500 or so someones, as Gina has sacked or, sorry, sadly had to let go, 500 workers in the Pilbara. Reducing our mining activity while maintaining our production rate, she explained, at Brickbats to Corb Lund, a big-time country music star in Canada, part of a huge campaign to prevent poor Gina developing a little coal mine in the Rockies just because of a bit of concern about water quality and wildlife. Corb saying he'd never spoken out in 30 years in the public eye, but this is so egregious. The risks are so high and the rewards are so low, the only people benefiting from it are the foreign coal companies. Foreign. That's our Gina. Imagine how she must feel as her altruism comes under attack. But meanwhile, as her bulldozer charges across the lodge lawn past the appalling UFC cage, her target displayed his usual courage under fire and buckled at the knees. I think that's a mixed metaphor. Yet again, who would have thought? So you've listened to the complaints and decided not to disassemble the NDIS. No, but we have listened to the caring business class complaints about forcing them to waste money on their tax lawyers. And as big economic guru Jim Chalmers at Capital and I point out, the budget is the basis for consultation with the disability community. No, why do you keep talking about something that is not negotiable? After all, the budget is final. Now, some things are certain, like Anthony and the team going to water when the caring business class charges at them behind Gina's bulldozer. And the insurance industry, which held a conference this week, an insurance summit it called it, and the big announcement, premiums will have to rise far in excess of inflation for years to come. Now, why did they need an expensive conference in a posh hotel to come up with the obvious? And grilled the workers, years of allegations of ripping workers off and audits finding serious food safety concerns, but obviously all wrong. Because Supremo Simon Crew Work Harder told us the 4,000 lazy, avaricious workers are his top priority. Forget about profit, it's the worker stupid. Number one priority, respected other, we assume, than conditions, proper work breaks and the little matter of paying them. And now, how grossly unfair. The Competition and Consumer Commission is suing poor grilled the workers over a promotion it ran that $1 from every burger sold on Tuesdays would be donated to an environmental cause. Turned out there were all sorts of terms and conditions. Whenever we see an offer too good to refuse and terms and conditions apply, we can bet they do. Anyway, of the thousands raised, only a pittance was donated thanks to the terms and conditions. And poor Grilled is being accused of greenwashing. It's just one thing after another, isn't it, for poor Simon? And back in Gina country, we can be so proud of the big true blue Aussie, BHP, bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, faced with the threat of industrial action by its ingrate wage slaves, workforce, attempting quite sensibly to recruit a rebel workforce to ensure life goes on. Rebel it's described as, and we must agree, because thanks to our sensible industrial relations laws, we know mouthing the word scab is now a criminal offence. And if the industrial action proceeds and the rebel workforce moves in, let's hope the lazy, avaricious strikers don't attempt to picket the worksite, because that too is a criminal offence. Finally, back where we started. Killer trample the poor and the phantom Ayatollah in the UFC cage. The Optimism of the Week award must go to the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sid headline last week, World Celebrates End of Iran War. With Benjamin in Donald's corner, wait and see, we say. Good afternoon.
And good afternoon to Mr. Kevin Healy. And tomorrow you can say good morning to the same Kevin at 9 o'clock for the program City Limits, which goes until 10 o'clock with friends.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
The New International Bookshop's Big Red Book Fair is back for 2026. We'll have thousands of secondhand books for super low prices and 20% off new books, plus many other cool things. This is a great moment to support Melbourne's longest running left bookshop. I'll see you on Saturday, the 18th of July, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. Can't wait to see you there. The New International Bookshop is a 3CR supporter.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
Following his observer mission in Iran, Dr. Tim Anderson travelled to Cuba, which has endured a six-decade-long US blockade and under threat of a takeover. I spoke with Tim yesterday and began by stating that the last visit was one of many to the island nation over the past 25 years and asked how severe conditions are compared with earlier times.
It's as bad as the 90s. It's as bad as the 90s in terms of shortages. There's shortages of everything. The transport's almost ground to a halt. But people are surviving, with lacking lots of things, and they're very experienced in having shortages and dealing with shortages, you know. But the things are very, very difficult, and I think people are probably starting to suffer malnutrition generally.
When you say shortages in fuel or electricity or gas or things like that, how does that actually impact on people in their homes where they live?
It's very difficult to get to work or to get to school or to get to hospital, those sorts of basic things, you know. So, for example, commuting to work, for example, if they want to come into the city, they might have to pay $1.50 or $2, which is a huge amount out of a salary if they've got a salary, you know. So it's just, there still is some transport, you know. There are collective private taxis, for example. There's no buses running, really, no public buses. And trucks, great difficulty with trucks, for example, to collect the garbage, you know, in the city, you know, so you have piles of garbage mounting up. If there isn't power, if there's blackouts, then you have water pumps don't work. People don't have access to clean water, for example, or they have difficulty cooking things, you know. So in the hospitals, when there's blackouts, everyone on life support dies. So there's really dire consequences of not having power. There are more electric vehicles. There is more renewable energy coming into the grid, basically, but still they haven't escaped the dependence on fuel for a lot of things.
When you say people going to work, what is work these days?
It could be anything, you know, any type of work that people go to that they still need transport to get there, basically. There is work, you know, people are getting really minimal salaries, you know, but the salaries... And there's been a partial dollarization so that people's salaries are insufficient for a lot of things that they want to buy, you know. Like I said, there is still, the work is still functioning, people are still eating, but it's becoming more and more difficult.
What about agriculture?
So agriculture's happening, you know. I was with the, and of course there's more urgency on relying on domestic production, on self-sufficiency in food and in fuel, and the aims of trying to be self-sufficient in food and fuel, which have been around for some time, but there's been very slow progress on it. There's more urgency given to that now. When I was with the Mayday Brigade back in May, there was 200 odd of us from different countries going and doing some voluntary work in a number of agricultural areas, in fruit orchards, in vegetable gardens and so on like that. So there are collective and individual farming going on around the outskirts of the cities. But the extent of it is not insufficient, basically. Cuba's been dependent on food imports for a very long time because it went down the path of export orientation, basically. You know, initially they were exporting sugar and other things, and now there's much greater emphasis on trying to be self-sufficient.
And where were the food imports coming from?
The wheat, when there's wheat for the bread, and of course there's always been state-subsidised basic bread rations for people. People queue up in the morning to get bread, but if there's shortage of wheat, sometimes they switch over to sweet potato flour to make bread, for example. Sometimes there isn't bread, you know, so there are shortages of bread. And the wheat has come from different Latin American countries. Typically, at the moment, it's coming from Mexico. There are supplies of food coming in. China has sent some substantial shipments of rice. But again, you have the transport problems make it difficult to share that rice around, basically. But Russia, China, Mexico, Uruguay, some other Latin American countries are sending some supplies to Cuba. But without fuel, it's difficult to process it. There is refining going on of Cuba's own oil, which is a very heavy oil, mainly on the north coast. And there is some new drilling for some of the offshore deposits of oil from the coast, that is to say horizontal drilling, which doesn't use, or near to horizontal drilling, which doesn't need offshore platforms, which should be vulnerable in an area which is hit by cyclones, you know, by hurricanes, basically. So there is a shift towards develop, and they're refining Cuba's heavy oil now, and that has some demands. You need diluents like naphtha, for example, and diesel. That's happening, but there's greater pressure on it to produce more, basically.
And the impact of the oil no longer coming from Venezuela?
That was a big factor in Trump's first term, and since COVID too, basically. That's because Venezuela was a very important partner. All of this, the 21st century, what we've had of the 21st century so far, and that's pretty much gone because Trump has effectively carried out a coup in Venezuela, which means that Venezuela is not meeting its contractual commitments to a number of partners. Cuba still has, for example, a big medical mission of doctors training and treating people in Venezuela, but they're being treated as individuals, given salaries now. There's not compensation to the Cuban health department for providing those missions. And the same thing with China. China provided a lot of credit to Venezuela in exchange for shipments of oil, and that's been blocked now because of the US is controlling the oil industry in Venezuela, basically.
While you were there, were you staying in a family home?
Yeah, at first, actually, with the brigade for about 10 days, I was staying with others in hotels. That we were staying in about three hotels to the west of Havana. And then after that, I was staying in family homes in old Havana.
What do the people say to you? Are they angry with the government? Do they know what's happening with Trump and what he's trying to do to them?
The people are not really angry with their own government. They are frustrated. They want the government to do things to break through these problems because the situation is extremely bad. But they know it's very obvious because of all of the language and the reporting of it and so on, and people are quite well informed still there. And the internet's quite good, despite everything, except when there's complete blackouts, that the Trump regime is imposing these things deliberately to try and starve the Cuban people and to try and take over the island again. That's been a long-term theme, basically. So people really want to see some sort of breakthrough. The older people have sort of gotten used to it in a better way. It's hardest for young people who are looking for economic opportunities. And so you find emigration, when they are able to emigrate, there's a lot of pressure for young people to emigrate. And almost every family has family members in the US, for example.
Is tourism stopped?
Tourism is almost at a complete standstill, basically. There are very few tourists there. If you go to restaurants in Havana there, for example, some of the slightly more upmarket private restaurants, then you'll see mainly some Cubans have money, and Cuban Americans that come to visit their families who have money, basically. So there is quite a deal of visiting by Cuban Americans because the latest generation of Cuban Americans have much better relations with the island, and they do visit their families and they support their families. But in terms of foreign tourists, there's a few hundred thousand tourists a month. But that's way down on what was happening before COVID. Before COVID and after Obama normalised relations with the Cubans, even though the blockade remained, there was up to 5 million tourists a year. And now, I don't know what the rate is, but it's I think the last figure I saw was a couple of hundred thousand in one of the earlier months of this year, basically. So it's happening, but it's way down. You have a lot of hotels. The capacity was built up before COVID and even during COVID to an extent. Of course, COVID crushed tourism during that pandemic, but that a lot of those hotels are basically empty or shut down, and the foreign partners have evacuated, basically.
And who are the Cubans with money?
The Cubans with money, there's sort of a new, I mean, there's always been Cubans, sports people and musicians who earn money overseas, who come back, they pay some tax, but they remain quite wealthy. So you have a small group there. But now, since the economic reforms of the early part of this century, you have Cubans that have some property, basically. In the late 20th century, retired people were renting out their rooms. They were licensed, retired people who were no longer working were renting out some of the rooms in their houses to tourists for private rooms. But since the reforms, the early part of this century, now you have anyone can do it, can rent out rooms for small businesses or for renting to for foreigners, for example, and also starting restaurants, private restaurants. So the people that have property have been actually making some money, and some of them are absentee, some of them are living in Canada or some other countries. And for example, one of the places I was staying in, the owner was actually in Canada but had some relatives sort of managing it for him there. So some Cubans are managing properties, basically, and you have a developing middle class through that type of reform. And the recent reforms in response to the crisis, by the way, the ones that were happening just last week, are going to expand that. Basically, there's an increasing level of marketization or controlled liberalization, let's say, because there's still a lot of social security guarantees there, but there are new liberalizing reforms which are privatizing to a certain degree certain parts of the economy. So that is creating inequalities, really, because you have some people who have resources can access things. There are goods, for example, there is food you can buy, for example, there that's not available on your salary, but you need the money. You need normally outside currency, which comes from remittances from family members outside or some other businesses that people have got to access it. So there is increasing inequality as a result of that rising middle class.
Is this increasing people unhappy about the system, that and pitting others, some against the others, if those who've got money and those who haven't?
Not really as yet. People are aware that there are families with money, obviously, you know, and people are queuing up to try and get remittances. Because like I said, virtually everyone has family members outside the country who is, to varying degrees, able to send them some money to help them get by, basically. And it's one of the biggest, now that the US has tried to block the Cuban doctors being contracted to other countries, it hasn't worked entirely. They're still working in some countries. There is still some foreign income there. But as a result of that, there's people are, you know, the export industry, so to speak, is really, the role of remittances has become much more important there. I don't think that there's the resentment to an extreme level yet, but there is a lot of desperation. There's desperate people, and then you have security problems. You have greater crime, for example, people breaking in and people more concerned about securing their houses from people who might steal things, basically. So there's greater crime and insecurity as a result that you have quite a number of quite desperate people.
Tim, you firmly believe that Trump will not destroy Cuba. Can you tell us why you have that belief?
Because in Cuba, I mean, Trump would like to, you know, he is a predatory sort of creature. He can't accept defeat either, as you see from the recent, his own sabotage of the so-called agreement with Iran. But nevertheless, the success that he had with Venezuela has encouraged him that there is this sort of possibility that by putting people under siege and by carrying out some so-called decapitation strikes, you know, assassinations and so on, kidnapping, as he did with President Maduro, that he can take control of a country by remote control, more or less. It was quite extraordinary what happened in Venezuela. We still don't know all the details, but we do know that there was some serious compromise, like a type of coup took place, and it had to do with corruption in Venezuela. So he would hope to do that in Cuba, but I don't believe that the same conditions are there for him to do that in Cuba, because the Cubans, of course, have more than 60 years of experience of dealing with being under siege and expecting an invasion, basically. And while it's true that the Cubans are militarily inferior to the US, we know now that there's this possibility of asymmetric warfare, which creates great problems for a big power like the US, basically. They failed against Iran. Okay, Iran is a bigger country, it has greater resources, but it was still an unequal fight in which the Iranians were able to prevail. Now, I think that the issue with the Cubans is that they have a strong commitment to resistance of being invaded or being dominated or taken over in that sort of way. And there's a, most importantly, there's a very strong link between mass organizations and the government, which means that this is going to be translated into reality if the US tries to invade. And they can't take over Cuba just by bombing it from the air, which they might begin with, as they did with Iran. They couldn't take over Iran just by bombing it with the air. They couldn't carry out a naval or a land invasion of Iran at all because they were so afraid of the consequences, and that's why they failed in the whole issue with the Straits of Hormuz and so on. Now, with Cuba, the case is going to be that there's going to be serious organized resistance. That organization is still in place. They have the channels of communication. You know, whenever they have a hurricane there, Cuba is extraordinary for a number of things, and one of them is that they hardly ever lose lives in a hurricane because they're so well organized and they can get boats out of the water, they can border up the windows of houses and so on. They have a very organized response when a hurricane comes along. So that level of organization is there for their civil defense too, and through the mass organizations like the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, all of the local committees and the trade unions and the women's organization, the students organization and so on, there will be serious resistance. And in the case of a ground invasion, which the US will require, the US will suffer serious casualties. And I think Trump, the Trump administration, understands this to a degree. They understand that they're going to, and they're very loss averse. They don't like the idea of losing US lives in an invasion. They boasted that they lost no lives when they kidnapped Maduro. I'm not sure that that's true, but anyway, they covered up the loss of lives in the Persian Gulf when all of those US bases were destroyed. They know that they're going to face serious loss of life in a ground invasion in Cuba. So, in other words, the Cuban people will be able to hang together to a degree to in face of an invasion, as you saw with the Iranians rallying in all the cities of Iran when they anticipated an invasion, but it never happened there. They'll be able to inflict serious damage on any invasion force. And I think that is going to, you see, there's one lesson that you might think that Trump wants some compensation for facing defeat in Iran by taking over Cuba. But on the other hand, he's going to be wary, additionally wary, because another loss is going to be devastating to him, basically, if there's serious losses of an invasion force. And remember that the US did try to invade Cuba back in 1961 and failed very quickly, failed in 3 days back then. Okay, things have changed, but I think that cohesion between the mass organizations and the people in Cuba and the government, which has very clear strategy in terms of dealing with an invasion, and also it has really been preparing for this for a very, very long time. You know, so it'd be fatal for the US to underestimate the dangers of an invasion there. I think that sort of cohesion is still there, and the intelligence at the Cuban level is still there too. For example, there have been many attempts to infiltrate Cuba and through Cuban organizations and so on, and they've been detected many times. The more than 600 attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, they didn't fail just by coincidence. It wasn't just an accident. They failed because they were detected. So the Cuban intelligence is very good, and they'll see attempts at subversion, attempts at infiltration and so on very quickly.
When you look at all the other countries in the region where Trump has tried to dislodge governments, and they have in most cases, there's no economic prize for Cuba,
much less so. You're right that one of the factors that's an incentive for Trump is that there's some sort of treasure to be plundered. And of course, Venezuela was the big prize, the big treasure to be plundered there, getting his hands on Venezuelan oil. And remember, the US had its hands on Venezuelan oil for the entirety of the 20th century, for the whole 20th century, and including providing fuel for the US military in both of the world wars, for example. That came from Venezuela. So there was a big incentive for Trump to plunder Venezuela. There's not the same thing there. There are some assets there. For example, there's a Trump associate which has taking over the Canadian company Sherritt, which was a major partner in Cuba's nickel industry. The nickel is one of the few mineral export industries from Cuba, basically. And Sherritt withdrew recently under the threats from Trump because it faced that Trump is threatening foreign companies that do business with Cuba. That's why it's been a blockade of Cuba. It's not just an embargo, because there's always been aggression by the US against the third parties who are doing business with Cuba. So Sherritt has, for the time, pulled out, but a Trump associate has taken over or is about to take over Sherritt. And so there's the possibility that a Trump associate may try and resuscitate the wealth that was coming through nickel mining in eastern Cuba, basically. But I don't think that's at a level comparable with the oil of Venezuela or the oil of Iran, for that matter. Of course, Trump may have, apart from being pushed by the Israelis, who are very powerful in U.S. politics these days, or have been until recently, there was also the prospect of getting his hands on Iranian oil too, which is an enormous prize. So you're right, there isn't the same sort of prize or the promise of plunder in Cuba as there was in Venezuela.
And talk about the countries that do still support Cuba and are willing to, well, they're not part of the blockade or the sanctions, are they? They sort of thumb their nose up at the US and say, we'll keep on supporting Cuba. What can they offer Cuba when you're talking about China, Russia, Mexico? And I wonder why Mexico is allowed to continue to have relations with Cuba, being so close to the United States.
Well, Mexico never cut relations with Cuba, not in the whole history since the revolution in the late 1950s. Mexico has this tradition, even with conservative governments there, they maintain their close relationships. And remember, Cuba has also engendered a lot of goodwill around the world, in Latin America particularly, but around the world also, because it's always been sending out educational and health missions. It's been training, it's trained more doctors from foreign countries than the whole G7 put together. You know, it's still doing that. There are still hundreds of Palestinians and Latin Americans studying medicine in Cuba to this day, basically. And they're better off than most Cubans because I was talking to an East Timorese friend in Havana, for example, last month, and he is getting an allowance from his government, from the East Timorese government, which isn't rich, but it's giving them, you know, $900 a year or something like that, which makes them, puts them well up into the upper middle classes in Cuba, basically. So the students are still being supported there. Of course, the Timorese government is paying for the postgraduate scholarships that they're there on these days. But nevertheless, you know, you have this relationship between most of the Latin American countries and a number of African countries and a number of other little countries like East Timor and Pacific Islands, which there's a big reservoir of goodwill for Cuba out in the world there. Then you have the big countervailing powers, Russia and China. Russia is the last country that sent a shipment of oil to Cuba. That was in March. That fuel is now all gone, although there's been some hoarding of it and there's some black marketing of some of the fuel and some of the diesel for some of the private cars and taxis and so on. So Russia and China have helped. China's been sending rice in particular and also solar panels to build their renewable network, which taps into the national electricity grid. Mexico was sending fuel until recently, but Mexico was... And remember, there's a lot of US financial links into Mexico, which give the US some additional economic control over the Mexican economy, apart from what the government does. But Mexico has been consistently sending aid, but they were blocked by the Trump regime from sending fuel, and Mexico has a lot of fuel, with a threat of tariffs. So basically, President Claudia Sheinbaum has said we are going to resume shipments of fuel to Cuba, and they'll find some way to do it to try and get around the US block by using private companies instead of the Pemex, the public Mexican company. So Russia had a second fuel ship which was on the way to Cuba and was deterred in some way. The Trump regime managed to deter that second Russian ship just fairly recently, just a few weeks ago, basically. So there are constant attempts to try and there's a huge amount of goodwill towards Cuba because of its historical record of internationalism. So I think that's going to be another asset in Cuba's favor, basically. It's possible that another Russian ship may arrive. It's possible that actually some Mexican fuel may arrive. Also, what's happening is the Trump regime has begun to license the private supply of fuel to embassies and private companies in Cuba, because remember, you've got the US embassy sitting there in Havana without diesel for its generators, and they've been begging the Cuban government to try and get fuel, and the Cuban government saying, well, if you're not going to allow it to anyone else, why will we provide it to the US embassy? So the US itself is trying to build a constituency, a political constituency, on the island. They want, you know, small business people or medium business people to have relations with them and to be then a sort of a type of a fifth column for them, basically. So the US has already moved to try and open up the private supply of fuel to certain businesses and embassies. And that's going to be difficult to quarantine because at the same time you've got hospitals that have no fuel. So it's going to be very hard to quarantine that sort of fuel. They'll open up some sort of grey market or black market there. So there's a number of pressures there which are countervailing factors really working in Cuba's favour.
Yeah, well, Trump's already got egg on his face and much more from his defeat in Iran, and I imagine that he's not looking forward to a backstep on Cuba.
That's why I think that the wariness, I think that Trump probably won't even attempt an invasion because the wariness after Iran is probably going to be a stronger factor than his desire for compensation. I mean, he wants compensation for losing in Iran, but he's also wary that another asymmetrical defeat is going to be a disaster for him politically. Already you can see he can't deal with the defeat in Iran, really. He's claiming over in Europe that he's defeated Iran and he's threatening the Iranians again. You know, his type of personality simply can't deal with the situation he's facing at the moment. So I think the wariness will be a countervailing factor to the desire for revenge and compensation. Because as you say, there's no great prize in Cuba in terms of resources that he can steal in the short term. Of course, there's plans to privatize everything in Cuba. That the US has had that for a long time. But it's not the same as getting his hand on gold or oil, for example.
Finally, Tim, how then is Cuba to survive this severe situation?
Well, they are surviving at the moment with great difficulty. You know, as I said, it's like the 90s in a way. They have announced a new step, a new tranche of reforms, basically, to open up private business. Now, this is to some extent an extension of what they did in the 90s. You know, in the 90s, they opened up tourism. They allowed joint venture operations, you know, big companies to invest in hotels and so on. And they licensed a lot of small business that wasn't permitted beforehand. That was extended in 2010 when Raul Castro was president. Now we have a third wave of those types of reforms. But they're still, and they've looked at what happened in Vietnam, what happened in China, but they're still a long way short of, people make very dramatic statements about what's going on there. They're a long way short of Doi Moi in Vietnam or Deng Xiaoping reforms in China. But they're conscious of that and they're heading down that track to a certain extent, and that also short circuits to a certain extent any attempts to blame the government for being too bureaucratic and too restrictive and not allowing local economic solutions. You know, so they've been under pressure to have this latest round of reforms, and of course it's happening while there's an intense siege going on. But as I say, there are cracks in the siege there, and I don't think Trump can sustain it for a long time, basically, because there are already the cracks through which Cuba's friends are providing some sort of aid and finding ways to break through, basically. I think the test will be if Russia and Mexico are able to break through with some fuel in the next few months. But remember, Cubans have been living with shortages for many, many decades. So while they are suffering, like many other little countries under blockade, remember, sanctions hurt little countries much more, little countries like Cuba and Nicaragua and Syria, for example, than big countries like Iran or Russia, basically. But nevertheless, there are those international networks which are working in Cuba's favour, as well as the experience of living. Really, most people in Cuba, remember, everyone who's less than 65 years old has grown up and lived under siege, under a blockade, basically, with shortages, you know. So they find ways to deal with these sorts of things, even though they're suffering. They're sharing the malnutrition together, basically.
Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you.
And Dr. Tim Anderson is an activist and a writer.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
In 1974, a report to the Whitlam government found that a large number of new radio stations could be accommodated in Australia with few technical problems. In June of that year, groups and individuals who were aware of public broadcasting overseas got together at the Pram Factory in Carlton. The Community Radio Federation developed out of that meeting. A new Melbourne licence was advertised in January 1975, and the Community Radio Federation applied for it. Following hearings in mid-1975, Dr. Moss Cass awarded the licence to the Community Radio Federation ahead of 11 other applicants. On October the 10th, just 1 month before the Whitlam government was sacked.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
To donate, call 03 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au.
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARACBEACON @gmail.com.
Bury public housing! Stop the demolition!
A 3CR supporter.
G'day folks, the 3CR Gardening Show's annual radiothon is coming up soon. Sunday the 28th of June from 7:30 to 10 a.m, and we'd love you to be a part of it. This year's Gardening Show Radiothon is extra special. 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. That's 5 decades of community radio, independent voices and programs like ours that you simply won't find anywhere else. Community radio doesn't run itself. Your support during Radiothon is what keeps the Gardening Show on air, paying for airtime, equipment and everything that goes into bringing our program to you full of gardening goodness every week. Show your support. We've got some wonderful goodies up for grabs. Garden tools, quality tools, nursery vouchers, subscriptions and much more. If you can't call in on the day, that's fine. You can make a tax-deductible donation online at 3cr.org.au. Every contribution makes a real difference. In 3CR's 50th year, there's never been a better time to stand behind the station and the shows that really matter to you, like The Gardening Show. The Gardening Show Radiothon is Sunday the 28th of June, 7:30 a.m. to 10 a.m, celebrating 50 years of 3CR goodness.
Continuing the interview with Alison Bronowski, AM, former Australian diplomat and member of Australians for War Powers Reform, we discussed an article she had published in Pearls and Irritations, Duterte's Trial Should Worry Trump, and that was the title. In the closing sentence was the fact that Australian leaders might remember that those who lie down with dogs end up with fleas. And we're wondering what birthday present our Prime Minister is going to take with him when he goes to see the illustrious President soon for his birthday, his 80th birthday.
We're not sure, actually. It's just been suggested that later this month, Prime Minister Albanese will go to the United States. But in my view, and perhaps in the view of many Australians, the kindest present he could offer Trump would be a way out of the current impasse that Trump has built for himself and found himself in the Middle East. That's one, saying to him, look, we don't support this. Get the hell out of it. Number two, tell President Trump to save himself the time and expense and money of providing submarines to Australia. Thanks very much. We don't need them. If we need them, we'll get them somewhere else. Keep them and we will save ourselves some money and you some as well. And that, I think, would reinforce a whole lot of things that are good for us all.
And also tell him to sort of cut some of the funding, if not all the military funding, from his great friend Netanyahu, and that would end up with a lot more peace in the Middle East, surely?
It surely would, and as well as that, it might pay for a few more decent hospitals and schools and roads and all kinds of social services that at the moment are being impoverished in many countries, in the United States and in Australia too. And I think, of course, both Trump and, you mentioned, Netanyahu, both of them face elections before the end of this year. And if, as Israel likes to say, it's the only democracy in the Middle East, it's a very good opportunity for them to show what that means. I just hope that Australia would break our years-long habit of imitating the worst things about the United States and failing to imitate the best.
Exactly. Okay, well, I must ask you what you think of Miss Hansen before I go.
Well, my daughter made a film about her called Please Explain. And as a result, my filmmaker daughter gets interviewed all the time about Pauline Hanson. And she always says that Pauline Hanson has had the same lot of principles, has always stuck to them, and has done so for 30-odd years. And that is probably, her consistency is probably her greatest quality. Her racism is part of that consistency, of course, and her intolerance of anything different from people like herself, her idea that everybody who is not people like herself should not be in Australia and should not be Australian, let alone what the opinion of Indigenous Australians might be about people who have arrived like her and her ancestors. That, all of that, is Pauline Hanson's nature, and as such, it can't be expected to change. What is changing and is so interesting is her discovery of big money and the perks that go with it. Here's this former fish shop owner who runs her own farm, you know, is a good sort of down-to-earth country girl from Queensland. And now she's discovered big money and Mar-a-Lago and her own plane given her by Gina Reinhart. And so she's becoming more Trumpian by the day, living the high life with lots of money coming in. And one waits to see what the effect of that is going to be on her politics. Plus, Australia always, as I said, copies the worst about the United States. And I'm afraid that in this situation, we're going to do the same. There are Americans who think Trump is terrific because he's made a lot of money. Therefore, he must be good for them. There may be Australians who look at Pauline Hanson and her rich mates and think, well, she knows how to get that sort of life. Maybe that's good for us too. Now, this is very simplistic thinking. And for her and for the press to claim that she has a chance of being prime minister just because she's a preferred leader, we haven't got an election for 2 years. She has to build a party first. She says she's going to run a candidate in every state in Victoria. And I seem to remember Clive Palmer running a candidate in every seat. The only purpose for doing that is that they get paid, even if they don't get elected. They get paid by the Commonwealth for having stood a candidate. And that's how Pauline Hanson has financed One Nation for years and years and years, out of the failed candidates that she's put up in various places. She's still doing it. So is Clive Palmer. And that kind of operation doesn't look good, doesn't smell good. And I wonder how long it will be before most Australians realise it isn't much good.
Well, when she starts to put forward a few policies, it might make a difference too.
Well, it will certainly make a difference. And I would like to know, as one of her policies, how she's going to fund a 5% of GDP for Australia to spend on defence, so-called. Militarism is the exact term. And she doesn't give us any details about where that money's coming from and what those faithful followers of hers who think she's going to improve their lives, what improvements to their lives she's going to make if she's going to spend 5% of GDP on defence. I mean, it's bad enough at the moment to be squandering the money we're squandering on weapons of war without being able to build a high-speed rail link or a freight link between Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. This kind of thing is what she doesn't specify. We don't know what her specifics are because she doesn't have any. There are no policies out there that are costed or quantifiable. So before people fall in for this idea that Pauline Hanson's going to save the day, they better find out how she's going to save the money.
Well, we're going to have a bit of it in the next little while, aren't we? Because the way the media is pandering to her everything she says, it's going to be a long, what is it, nearly 2 years to the next election? 18 months?
It is. But I noticed with some interest that although I have this year, I have given up reading the Murdoch media because it makes me angry and I spend the whole day being angry and I'm much less angry when I haven't read that. So I have missed a lot, but I was reading a fascinating account today of how the Murdoch media at first was terribly excited about the Hanson phenomenon and how this was going to change everything until Paul Kelly, their editor-at-large, published a critical piece saying, well, actually, she doesn't agree with the things that Lachlan Murdoch wants. And all of a sudden, the policy of the Australian turned around to being very critical of Hanson and finding all sorts of things wrong with her, particularly about, you know, how much tax she's paid and how many sitting days she has not attended the parliament, etc., etc., you know, like not hanging crimes, but misdemeanors, as you might say. And this appears to be taking place because the Murdoch media is being told by Lachlan to get behind the coalition. And so before the coalition falls down the drain, the Australian is going to rebuild them in its time-honoured fashion, win the next election to show that they can. And the loser in that operation would either have to be Labor or would have to be One Nation. So we wait to see.
It could be called Interesting Times, but I'm not quite sure, Alison.
I think it's a curse.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Talk to you again soon.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Here we are, we're all in the middle of the desert and there's such a feeling of optimism. It's fantastic and everyone really knows what they're doing, is very quietly determined and yet having a good time at the same time.
The cheers are going up now as three parachutists jump out of a plane right above the Honeymoon uranium mine site.
The hundreds of thousands of people who have been marching around the streets of Melbourne this afternoon are now heading off to the Domain. So if you're at home and you've been enjoying the coverage but you still feel like being part of it, you certainly can. Just go on down there to the Domain where there'll be speeches and music and
3CR.
And 3CR. Always carry your tranny along with you so that you can hear what's going on.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
To donate, call 039-419-8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au.
Speaking now with veteran US peace activist Kathy Kelly, as the country recovers from the commemorations of the 250 years of independence and Trump's birthday, only to be overcome by football. Kathy, you've witnessed the impact of US wars in many countries, particularly in the Middle East, where you were there with the Iraqi people in the days of Shock and Awe in 2003. Here we are 23 years later, and it's the people of neighbouring Iran which you turn the US latest war of choice. You want to call attention to the similarities between these two US attacks on sovereign nations.
Well, I think that the United States certainly punished the Iraqis horribly in between the 1991 Gulf War and the 2003 Shock and Awe bombing, because the economic sanctions that were imposed on Iraq were never lifted. 13 years of brutally lethal economic sanctions. And we should keep in mind that Iran has been suffering many, many negative economic consequences because of years now of United States sanctions that have been designed to try to accomplish regime change in a kind of long, slow, drawn-out way. Well, now the United States decapitated the Iranian regime, and it seems that even more ruthless hardliners in the Iranian government have replaced the former government, and the Iranian military is, I think, showing that it's quite strong in terms of being able to withstand attacks and wage attacks, including attacks against U.S. allies. So, you know, what has happened to Iranian civilians? Well, you know, their infrastructure has been pounded. And when you attack civilian water infrastructure, that's a war crime. Of course, the attack on the girls' school in Manav was a terrible war crime. And, you know, Iranian ordinary civilians are certainly suffering from multiple attacks, but it isn't clear that the Iranian government is coming to the negotiating table with J.D. Vance saying, you know, oh, the U.S. has the upper hand. In fact, it might be quite the opposite.
But unlike Iraq, there are no U.S. troops on the ground.
Troops on the ground, it could be, it might, you know, a suicidal mission for the United States. But I think that the Israeli attacks on Lebanon, which might have been restricted in the last day, have caused horrific consequences in Lebanon. And of course, Israel continues to attack Gaza as well, and the West Bank.
And the number of women and children who have been killed in Gaza and more in the West Bank and continuing in Lebanon. Is that something new for the US, or has that always been happening?
Well, I think the United States has always had a high tolerance for killing women and children. We saw that in the Vietnam War. We certainly saw it in the Iraq War. Many women and children suffered and were displaced and bombed in the war in Afghanistan. So, and certainly the Israelis have shown enormous ruthless tolerance for killing women and children. The technology for doing that has been steadily developed in very, very sinister ways. I mean, right now there's two Danish reporters received a very prestigious European Union prize. It's kind of like the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize in the United States. And these two reporters had interviewed medical doctors who went for 2 and 3 week missions to Gaza. And when the notes of all of these doctors were compared, they realized that over 116 children under age 15 had been shot with bullets that went into their heads or torsos, fired quite likely by snipers or quadcopters. And the rounds and rounds and rounds of ammunition that the United States sends to Israel enables Israel to kill children, along with healthcare workers and journalists and so many other people who have committed no crime whatsoever. And the technology for creating lists of people who will be killed is also sent to Israel from the United States. And major U.S. technological conglomerates supply Israel with the capacity to develop the algorithms and create lists of who is going to be targeted for assassination. And now we see this happening in Lebanon as well. And the Iranians are saying, stop it, or we won't agree to the ceasefire.
Also thinking back to the war on Vietnam by the US and the vow they made that never again would they tolerate media being present in the country while they were at war. And this sort of shows the number of journalists who have been murdered in not only Palestine but Lebanon and Iran.
260 journalists, at least, have been killed. And then so many others have been maimed or their family members have been attacked. And I think anybody who witnesses these atrocities is at enormous risk. And that, of course, includes the healthcare workers. 80,000 doctors are in prison with no charge. And there are 1,700 healthcare workers who've been killed. I think when the United States said that it was going to put an end to the Vietnam syndrome, that led to embedding reporters during the shock and awe bombing so that the reporters would be dependent on the military to protect their lives, and also making sure that people in the United States didn't see the consequences of the attacks that the United States was making against Iraq. And, you know, to this day, Israel is not allowing any reporters to enter, any international reporters to enter into Gaza. And in fact, a special rapporteur for the United Nations identified Israel as a country that has been violating the rights of children and sexually abusing prisoners and others. And the Israeli representative to the ambassador to the United Nations, Mr. Danan, literally screamed at the UN official who had submitted this report. And really, the president of the UN Security Council should have, I believe, told Israel, you can't behave like that and still remain as a member of the United Nations.
I often wonder how much of this carnage is available to the people in Israel. And then I think, well, it might get on the mass media, but this social media, and almost every family in Israel must have someone in the IDF or has been in the IDF.
Well, that's true. And I suppose we also should recognize the levels of suicide that have risen amongst Israeli soldiers. Sometimes it's only reported as a suicide if the soldier is in active duty. But amongst soldiers who are no longer in active duty, there's been a arise in this moral injury that leads to committing suicide amongst higher numbers. And so it's curious to me that the Israeli public continues to support Prime Minister Netanyahu in waging wars and is disappointed that he hasn't been able to supposedly protect Israelis by attacking Lebanon. But yeah, for sure, the reports that are in the mainstream news, with the exception of Haaretz in Israel, must be bolstering the public desire for war.
Could we talk about the so-called peace process that's going on between the United States and Iran? It's not a peace deal, really. It's just talking, and it can be broken at any time.
Well, yeah, and you know, the Congress of the United States has been shameful. In fact, right now there are bipartisan criticisms of the Memorandum of Understanding, which might have led toward a 60-day ceasefire. And I also recognize that there are Democratic elected officials who want Trump to fail in his war and in his policies, and they won't enact the War Powers Act and stop him from sending more weapons or waging another war. They could do that, but those bills have been raised and they haven't been passed. And I think that's because they want to see Trump fail.
And the targeting of the U.S. bases around the region, mainly against Arab kingdoms, highlights the fact that the U.S. is so far away from Iran.
Right, and I think that people continue with the myth that somehow war makes people secure, or the military makes people secure, and it doesn't. We certainly see that the military bases in other countries aren't making those countries more secure. They'd be a lot better off. They'd be a lot safer if they didn't have these sprawling military bases in their countries. But you're right. In the United States, the war is quite far away. There's a lot of drone operation and drone surveillance that is conducted. And I think that the United States isn't seeing any troops coming home who've been maimed or coming back in body bags. And so the U.S. public is perhaps not as disturbed, although the closing of the Strait of Hormuz and the rising of gas prices certainly is a disturbance. And to the less affluent families, it's much more than a disturbance. It's creating a huge hardship for people to get groceries and fuel. And the Congress people, again, if they can count on a disgruntled public to vote against Republicans in the midterm elections, and that's something they see in their favor. But it would be far better to end this war as soon as possible.
We bring into the conversation the Pope Leo IV, not backwards in coming forwards on this issue.
Well, it's, I think, admirable that he stands his ground. And he has made it very clear that people all around the world should raise their voices and stand up to the powers and military powers, that there's too much suffering and too much killing in our world. And, you know, I think about Catholic universities across the United States that squelched the student encampments on their campuses. And it's my hope that some of those universities would start to pay attention to what the Pope is saying, and likewise the Catholic bishops. They have a Pope saying the constant militarization of our societies is wrong. And yet, the bishops don't pick up on that message very well. A few do. There are three cardinals also who have, I think, begun to speak in a fashion similar to Pope Leo. But there could be a big shift in public opinion and perception if the Catholic bishops would start to speak out against war-making.
Back to the so-called peace deal for a moment. What are your feelings at this moment?
No, and President Trump has already said, I can start bombing anytime I want, even after the 60 days as well. So there's much to be negotiated between the two sides, and President Trump is actually threatening the Iranian delegation itself.
And the continued emphasis on Iran building a nuclear weapon. They've been saying for decades now that they will not build a nuclear weapon, but Israel and the United States keep using this as a pretext for war.
Well, again, I think the double standard is so terrible. Israel already has at least 91 thermonuclear weapons, according to the CIA. It's likely they've got 200 or possibly more than that thermonuclear weapons. And Israel never declares it. Israel never allows the International Atomic Energy Association to enter into its weapon-making facilities or its storage places. And, Iran does not have the bomb. They say they don't want a nuclear bomb. But it is, I suppose, the leverage that they're not willing to give up in terms of enriched uranium. But the introduction of nuclear weapons into that region has been made by Israel, and is you almost never see a word about that in the United States media. It seems like the International Atomic Energy Association been allowed to go into the facilities that Iran has in Isfahan and Natanz, and I don't believe they actually have developed a nuclear bomb. Now, Saudi Arabia is also looking to get the technology, and once you have the nuclear, the technology for nuclear energy, it's not a far distant step to create a nuclear bomb.
And now we have the seemingly overwhelming emphasis on anti-Semitism in the Western world.
Well, the idea that it's anti-Semitic to criticize people who are committing genocide, who are waging genocide, seems so outrageously wrongful and cruel-headed, and yet we see this repeated again and again. The AIPAC has managed to insinuate itself, I think, in numerous governments. And for instance, Palestine Action in the UK, those young people who were part of the destruction of property at the Elbit Systems factory, were, I think, engaging in what we've often called a plowshares action. Beat the swords into plowshares, beat your spears into pruning hooks. This is a line that comes from the Hebrew scriptures, and it's something that's been part of Christian tradition for a very long time. But the sentences that were passed on by the judge in the UK were quite long, 6 to 8 years for four people who had been part of that destruction of property at the Elbit Systems. And we see even carrying a sign saying, I support Palestine Action, can be punishable by time in prison. And here in the United States, we're also getting constant messages in the universities that it's anti-Semitic to raise protest, even when it's Jewish Voice for Peace that's organizing a protest. And there's another weapon manufacturing group called L3Harris, and that company has actually written to the court saying, hand out stiffer sentences to these protesters. So the usage of anti-Semitism charges has been, I think, employed by AIPAC particularly, but we're now seeing that some people running for elected office who have accepted large AIPAC contributions are finding that that hurts them in their electioneering seasons. Well, it certainly is a huge problem that the Israeli lobby has been as strong as it is because they can wield a great deal of power within political and academic circles. But what we're told here is that the ground is beginning to shift amongst young people, that there's no longer a preference for Israel. In fact, it's the opposite, that younger people are beginning to be far more supportive of Palestinians. Now, whether this can make a difference on time for the people who are suffering so desperately in Gaza and increasingly in the West Bank, I don't know. But we might find that Israel's obstinate refusal to acknowledge their violations of international law, or, you know, when you think about the flotilla and the way in which the people were tortured and treated so miserably when they were imprisoned for just a few days, brings people back to their countries speaking about what is happening to Palestinians who are imprisoned for years under these sadistic situations.
It's been headlined a world first. Australia will now investigate Israel. The Australian government has committed to an independent investigation into the assaults, sexual assaults, and the torture of Gaza flotilla humanitarians. Juliet Lamond, Isla Lamond, and Niamh O'Connor.
Well, I surely hope that they go far enough to charge Israel with war crimes, but that seems perhaps a bit of an elusive goal. When I think about the possibly now we're looking at a $3 trillion sum that's going to go to the military when you count in all of the ways in which military branches and veterans and other expenditures for military buildup are counted in. I mean, imagine if this an effort like the flotilla effort had even just one half of 1% of that huge budget, what a huge, enormous flotilla could be formed. And, you know, what they've done already on a much, much smaller budget has been almost miraculous, I think. But then this is an amazing show of courage on the part of the flotilla activists. But yes, it's reprehensible. But on the other hand, you don't want weaponized ships sent by governments either, because this is intended to be a completely nonviolent action. But, you know, when the activists got back to Greece, where the Israelis had taken them to, there were many countries that didn't assist them to get back to their home countries. Fortunately, the Turkish government sent a plane and gave people passage back to their home countries. But the United States diplomats never came near any of the people who had been so grievously harmed. You know, I belong to World Beyond War, and our board treasurer is a medical doctor, John Brewer, and he's been giving very effective presentations and been on the media. And so another person, Hueda Araf, was part of the flotilla effort and has been coordinating much of it, and she'll be on a speaking tour around the West Coast in the United States. And then Colonel Anne Wright has been just a brilliant organizer and spokesperson for the flotilla, and she'll also be speaking in the United States.
Was Anne on the last flotilla?
She sailed for part of it, and then she was mostly doing coordination on shore, on land.
And this war on the people of Gaza continues, as well as the West Bank.
Yeah, it's, when you think about people in Gaza who have now been subject to the cold of winter, living in tents, the rains that came, now the hot sun is pouring down on them, and it's like living inside of an oven, and they're still not getting the humanitarian aid that they need. The trucks are still being restricted. The suffering that's been imposed on the people is so horrid. And now the Israelis have got big cranes that they've outfitted with weapons that get the fire indiscriminately, so that people are living under so much tension and fear. And of course, Israel has been angling for greater Israel to take over land, annex land in the West Bank, take over Gazan land. And, you know, they want to weaken people to the point where people will say, send us anywhere. We can't stay here. We can't bring our children up any longer under these conditions. So the idea that the wealthy countries of the world wouldn't have merciful and just approaches toward the people in Gaza is an indictment, I think, of all of our countries.
Unfortunately, not a time for anti-war activists to rest on their laurels.
No, it's not looking very good right now. The possibilities for another war opening up against Cuba are also there. And, of course, the United States is constantly angling to challenge China. We live in very precarious times.
I've been speaking with U.S. anti-war activist Kathy Kelly.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Only 3CR takes things that the other radio stations wouldn't even take a sniff at.
In early 1980, Dollar Brand visited Australia, and whilst he was here, he played a special benefit for 3CR in recognition of the station's role in fighting racism in South Africa.
So I think our role as broadcasters was quite phenomenal in making those connections with people out there who probably had no other connections with other gay and lesbian people.
The station is unashamedly left-wing, and many of its programs stick in the throat of political conservatives.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
To donate, call 03-9419-8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
A great deal appears to be happening around AUKUS, and to explain the likely consequences, I spoke with Bevan Ramsden from the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, IPAN. It's been a long time coming, Bevan, but finally the cracks appear to be happening. Is it 2 plus 1, or is it 1 plus 2, or is it 3 plus nil when the submarines are discussed? A nationwide public inquiry was officially launched on the 2nd of June, initiated by the Australian Peace Security Forum. What will IPAN's contribution be?
The Australian Peace and Security Forum initiated this inquiry, and IPAN is supporting it too. I've made a submission, 3,000 word submission to it. It's open, of course, for submissions from anyone, and the more the better. They've been very wise in choosing commissioners who have some public standing. I mean, when you've got former Admiral Chris Barry, Australian Defence Force, retired, as one of commissioners, Peter Garrett, who's pretty well known, Carmen Lawrence, former Premier of Western Australia and ALP Premier, they're among these commissioners. It gives it some public standing, and it is helping to publicise the issues around AUKUS. Yeah, I certainly encourage people who are listening to this program of yours, Jan, to get in touch. They can go to the website, Australian Peace and Security Forum, or just look up AUKUS Public Inquiry, and on the internet you'll get through to where you can make submissions or read all about it. I guess yourself and I, we have concerns about AUKUS, as so do our listeners, because it's an enormous amount of money being proposed to be spent on eight nuclear submarines, $375 billion. Professor Richard Tanter, who some of the listeners will know, has said that because they haven't designed this new submarine for Australia, the SSN series, yet, and they haven't built one at the Osborne Shipyard in South Australia, which is where they're supposed to be built, this proposed $375 billion could well blow out many times. And Professor Tanter thought maybe to $1 trillion. Well, what sort of tax burden is that on the Australian people when we've got housing needs and fuel and security needs and medical security needs, and we can go through all those things, the climate crisis and dealing with that, to spend and focus that enormous amount of money, public money, our tax money, on what would be 5 plus 3, three from the United States submarines, is just unbelievable.
And they're not for our benefit, are they? If they ever do come, they're part of the US war machine.
Exactly, Jan. There's people like Senator Rex Patrick. Now, he was a submariner himself. He was the former South Australian Senator, Rex Patrick. He and others have said that Australia could acquire 20 air independent subs, that's the new modern ones that Japan and Sweden have got, for $30 billion, for 8% of that touted $375 billion. 20 for that. They're being smaller and quieter, are very suitable for Australia's coastal waters, particularly in the shallower parts around the eastern north, whereas these big, heavy nuclear-propelled ones are not really suitable for shallow waters and are meant for distant warfare. Now, the question is, what distant warfare and for whom? And as you've said, and others have said, that the ones that the Americans are going to sell to us, the three second-hand Virginia-class, we'll have a stipulation with them that we're only giving them, letting you have them, providing you promise to use them with us in any of our wars. And, of course, the one war that we're particularly worried about is the one against China. So, yes, that's what they're really meant for, these big, heavy, long nuclear subs can last a long time underwater, in distant waters, far from here. They're not about defending our territory, our coastal waters. They're about being used with the United States in their wars of aggression. And why do we spend so much money for that purpose? That's the question.
And there is concern also that there might be plans for a nuclear submarine base in the Illawarra. How far ahead do you believe that is?
Well, as you know, we've got the base is being developed right now in Perth, well, in Fremantle, Rockingham, Garden Island, and the Yanks are moving in fast there with support services, the maintenance crew, and what they call a submarine squadron 3 to coordinate it all. They're working hard on that one. And the governor said by the end of the century, in the decade, by 2030, they will have chosen a place on the east coast of Australia for a second port for American nuclear submarines. And Illawarra, Port Kembla has been talked about, Newcastle's been talked about, and possibly Brisbane. That really got organised around Port Kembla. And I actually went in a march a couple of years ago on May Day. It was a huge crowd that went right up the main street opposing Port Kembla being used. And the electoral trade union there has taken a stand and said, we won't work on any nuclear submarine or associated port if that is done here in Port Kembla. And they've been advocating a wind farm, a turbine wind farm off the coast of Illawarra as an alternative way of spending money usefully for renewable energy and job creation. Because one of the selling points of this nuclear submarine business is that, creating the port will create jobs. With $375 billion, you could create an awful lot of useful jobs, maybe re-establish an electric car industry or establish an electric car industry, really get into the renewables in a big way. We could do so much for Australia's infrastructure, which would be of long-term value and immediate value to us compared to putting money into a port for the US from which they can operate with their nuclear subs.
And it seems to be an increasing number of areas of our real estate that is actually going to be used by the US war machine. What has upset many, many people in the housing crisis is the over 1,000 houses that are going to be built by the Australian government to house the US service people in Western Australia.
Yes, that's so. And there's a crying need for housing, as everyone knows, and yet they're prepared to allocate taxpayers' funds to build houses, not expecting the Americans to pay for it themselves. No, we'll be providing housing for 1,000 personnel, American personnel, and their contractors and families, and who, by the way, will be putting pressure on the schools, the medical services, all the services in that area with 1,000 American personnel and families. What does that do to housing availability and to the pressure on services because of that commitment that the government's made? So, yes, that is another aspect of it, Jean, that diversion of public money to assist the Americans. And you said about America's presence elsewhere on the continent. IPAN is producing a booklet, The Heavy US Military Footprint on Australia. And you'd be amazed at how many places their military are in now with us or by themselves. I've listed 20 of these around Australia, not just in Robinson Barracks in Darwin, but, I mean, they have their own big fuel tank facility at East Arm in Darwin, all the aircraft fuel. A huge facility which is under their control. It's theirs, and they control that part of the territory. you know, apart from Pine Gap, which we all know about, the upgrading of the number of airfields for American bombers and fighters' use. One is in Curtin, Western Australia, one at Learmouth in Western Australia, Tyndall, I think $1 billion for enabling US B-52 nuclear-capable bombers to be stationed at Tyndall and the maintenance facilities there. The Darwin airport's to be upgraded, and also Shurga in northern Queensland and Amberley. All these are being upgraded for American forces to use, and we know for what purpose.
On a different aspect of the United States power in the world at the moment, I want to touch on Francisco Albanese.
Yes.
No relation, of course, to our Albanese. Mm. But I don't know many people. We know the sanctions. He's put on sanctions against her. But I didn't realise how damning these sanctions are. Can you explain?
Apparently, and I'm looking at a document in front of me here because I knew you were going to talk about it, Francesca has lost her affiliations with Columbia and Georgetown universities. Her assets were frozen. She cannot access bank accounts, credit cards, or payments anywhere in the world. They're just trying to destroy her life, her career, her family, and her voice. She's a United Nations special rapporteur on Palestine. She's spoken up about the genocide there. Now, not only have they sanctioned her, and it's called an American executed an executive order 14203. And in that, this is where the effect is implemented. It's not only her, but they've sanctioned 8 judges of the International Criminal Court, 3 court officials, and Palestinian human rights organisations, El Hanak, El Maizar, and PHAR, all because they have spoken up and brought to public attention what is going on in Palestine with the Israeli attacks on the Gaza, people of Gaza, etc. It's unbelievable that that the Americans would actually do that to people, international recognised people and judges and courts, to try and suppress criticism of what Israel is doing.
What amazes me is, though, that there's no body in the whole world that can counteract what the US is doing with these sanctions.
That's exactly right. We've got in IPAN's voice a petition to sign about pushing back on this, but that's, you know, as you say, there's no organisation able to, and not any real leaders in the world. They're very silent, been silent on the issue. And now, of course, the influence of the Zionists in Israel, in our own society, is so substantial. You know, I wouldn't have believed this a few years ago, but they've been able to get the Queensland government to make it a criminal offence to say publicly, from the river to the sea. You know, I mean, from what river to what sea? I mean, you know, but the river, those words are a criminal offence to say that in public, or globalised intifada. Now, the Queensland government has been persuaded by the Israeli Zionist lobby to do that. Now, what sort of influence do they hold? And of course, they've done it other things as well. I'm talking on radio station 3CR with you. And in 1978, they tried to close down and have 3CR's licence revoked. A very black time for 3CR. I remember it very profoundly. It was because I was secretary of the station, and our committee, myself and our committee, decided to give Palestinians a program on 3CR. Now, it was the first radio station in Australia to let Palestinians have a voice. And immediately the Jewish Board of Deputies reacted, and they tried to have the station's license revoked. That's the power of that Zionist lobby. We're not talking about being anti-Jewish here, Jan, not at all. Jews or any group of any religion is in Australia are entitled to their rights and their security and so on. We're talking about a lobby for a political idea and ideology associated with Zionism, and the behaviour of a state which is practising it in Palestine, which is Israel. And those who try and equate anti-Semitism with criticism of that country and what it's doing are quite wrong. Quite wrong. We should not have our voices silenced, like they're trying to silence Francesca Albanese or people in Queensland who say from the rivers to the sea. My gosh, we either have a democracy and some freedoms or not, and if this continues, we'll be very, very much suppressed in that area.
Well, we're also suppressed with this Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism.
Well, I think it's being run by a person who is themselves a pro-Zionist, so that is not a very good starting point, is it?
Have you been following the proceeds?
Not closely. I haven't. Have you, Jen?
No, I haven't. I feel so angry about it to think that this Australian government would initiate something like this to placate the Zionist lobby.
Exactly, placate the Zionist lobby. And I read an article by Andrew Brown, who was ex-mayor, I think, of Manly, in which he exposed a lot of the Zionist lobby's influence in government and institutions, including the ABC. And he's calling for a royal commission into foreign influence, the foreign influence of the Zionist lobby on Australia and Australia's institutions. Now, no government is going to implement it, not at the moment, that sort of royal commission, but that's what's needed. Now, you go to the United States, and here we have a war on Iran caused by the Zionist lobby, and the Israelis pulled Trump into that war, a terrible disaster, which I think they're starting to, he's starting to realise. I don't think they're going to let him out of it. They've got a ceasefire document of some sort, which they are going to be signed on. But Israel isn't party to it, and they will sabotage it, that's for sure.
Well, Israel has to sabotage it, doesn't it? Because Netanyahu can't support it.
No, that's right. Their position is that they want the war to continue. They want to destroy Iran. And what worries me is that the only one in the Middle East who've got nuclear weapons is Israel.
It amazes me all the time we have them over and over and over. Iran must never, ever have a nuclear weapon. Israel's bursting with nuclear weapons.
What is the ridiculous thing about this whole thing is that Iran's leader, the one they killed and assassinated, he put out a religious edict saying we will not have nuclear weapons. It's incompatible with our religion. Iran has signed the non-proliferation treaty about nuclear weapons. They've taken a really good stand, and yet Israel has constantly said, they're trying to get them. They're trying to get nuclear weapons, you know, and encourage this war, this disastrous war, in which the United States responded. And they're still trying very hard to get out of it and don't know how to. Well, things will go on for a while yet, unfortunately, and that will affect, because of the Straits of Hormuz, it's going to affect economies all around the world, including our own, which, by the way, it's shown up some of the weaknesses of our governments, successive governments' lack of planning and preparedness for security, fuel security, energy security, fertilizer security. You know, these are at stake because we import so much and don't bother making it. We've let things slide and let our manufacturing industry subside substantially. And so we make so little and import so much that we are vulnerable to shipping disruptions such as occur in a war.
The IPAN National Conference is being held in Adelaide next month. So I think for just those who have been, don't know what IPAN stands for, you better let us know first and then tell us what's likely to happen at the National Conference.
Yeah, look, IPAN, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, has been operating now since 2012 and was brought into being because of concern about the US Marines being stationed in Darwin. That's what it was in response to that. But IPAN stands for a peaceful and independent Australia, that is, one which has an independent foreign policy from the United States. We seek good trade and mutual beneficial relations with our with countries around us and our neighbours, and sets to promote peace in our region. Now, our conference in Adelaide has a theme. This is on the 24th, 25th, 26th of July, and I think we have 95 people registered for the conference. There's plenty of room for more still. But the theme of the conference is Time to Break Free from the USA. Not a bad sort of a title at this particular time in the in international relations and their relations with the US, because it's dragging us, they're dragging us into wars we don't need to be in.
You've got a wide variety of speakers.
We do. There's a great variety of speakers, and but more than that, lots of opportunity for participation in workshops and looking at ways of implementing change, how to take our message to the broader public, and how people can be involved in that. So it's a very participatory conference with some great speakers. We're also going to go up the river on a boat to see where they propose to build these nuclear submarines at Osborne Shipyard and see what's going on there. And we're going to protest outside the ALP National Conference on Friday morning, the 24th of July, just before our own conference starts. And should any listeners like to really be inspired by it and think, gee, I'd love to go to that conference, 24th, 25th, 26th of July, just go to the IPAN website, ipan.org.au, and you can pick up all the details.
And as this war with the United States and Israel continues on Lebanon and the other countries in the region, we have the Australian government, through different businesses throughout Australia, supplying weapons. And we find out more and more each couple of months that how many more are actually sending weapons, not straight to Israel. They're being clever, but they get there in the end.
Yeah, through a third country, through the USA or so on. And certainly Australia is supplying material, war material, that way to Israel. And as you know, there's been petitions and actions to pressure the government to stop doing that. And we should continue to do so and take whatever we can to break with any support for that out-of-control country.
Do you think there's more and more support within the Labor Party for them to change their stand on United States?
I really do. I really do think there's a lot more support there, but certainly the leadership is not really listening to its rank and file either, or its branches. Let's take one of the most obvious examples of that, Jan. The Australian Labor Party's national conferences have voted successively that when in government, we would sign the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, the TPNW. That was the motion initially to do that at an ALP national conference, was moved by Albert Albanese and seconded by Richard Marles.
Amazing, isn't it?
Now, they've got in. This is something which ICANN says 80% of Australians want signed as a step towards peace and keeping and getting rid of nuclear weapons. Now, that's a pretty strong mandate. But when in government, they've had two goes at this in the second term, not a sign. And, of course, there's a very good reason. When they get into government, they find that if you do sign a treaty and ratify it, you cannot support in any way the nuclear activities of another country. Now, Pine Gap, its intelligence facilities go to the nuclear war arm in the war office in the United States. It is part of their nuclear war fighting capabilities, whether it's intelligence. And the Northwest Cape tip of Western Australia at Exmouth Gulf is a huge antenna system built by the Americans, and the land they paid a peppercorn rent. It communicates with a 1 million-watt power transmitter, penetrates seawater and communicates with their nuclear submarines. And they can send a trigger signal to their submarines to launch a nuclear missile from Northwest Cape. So those two apart from Hajimir Sterling in AUKUS, the government just balks at the fact that, oh, gee, if we sign this, we're going to have to tell the Americans, you have to get out of Pine Gap. Sorry, you can't use Northwest Cape. And they haven't got the guts, they haven't got the Australian backbone to even think of doing that.
You wonder how many people have died because of that Northwest Cape and Pine Gap over all those years.
Exactly. I mean, the assassinations by drones, I mean, even maybe some of that assassinations in Iran could have been assisted by the intelligence and the satellites the Pine Gap worked to. So we have an involvement in those sorts of things through those American facilities. Australia is complicit in those illegal actions through those facilities.
And they say that whatever the United States gets from Pine Gap, the Israelis get it as well.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure that is passed on. So, you know, the conference in Adelaide of the IPAN is about, you know, the need to break with this US alliance and its associated military presence in Australia so we can come clean and act as a responsible country in the world and be peaceful. And that can only occur if we were able to get our independence back and our sovereign ability to do these things back, because we've traded that away in the American alliance.
The web page for people to book?
Oh, yes, to book for the conference, ipan.org.au, ipan.org.au, and you can find all the details there.
Thank you, Bevan.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jan. Pleased to speak with you.
And Bevan Bramson is indeed a member of IPAN, Independent Peaceful Australia Network.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.